नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्सा नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्सा नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्सा बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। The moon is moving towards, it's waxing, so it's moving towards full moon, I think, on Monday. And the full moon of July is an important day in Theravada Buddhism. It's a day we commemorate the first teachings of the Buddha. It's called Asala Puja. And the great celebrations of Theravada Buddhism are named, most of them, for the month that they take place in. So you have Vesaka Puja. Vesak is the month of May, as it was used in the time of the Buddha, and that celebrates the birth, enlightenment, and parinibbana of the Buddha. And then Asala Puja is the first teachings, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, or the teachings in the Four Noble Truths, or the turning of the wheel of the law. And we have a day called Magga Puja, which is a full moon of February, where we celebrate some events in the monastic order. And sometimes these are called Buddha Day, Dharma Day, and Sangha Day. And this monastery is called Tisarana. The three refuges are Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So it all kind of comes together quite nicely. So you could call it Dharma Day on Monday. But every day is Dharma Day, of course. So you don't have to call it that. But days, like in Thailand now, it's the beginning of the monsoon. In India it is. We have the monsoon, so that's quite fitting. to come together and remember a teacher, remember the teaching with a sense of devotion and gratitude, these are things which are national events in places like Thailand and Sri Lanka. The whole country is alive with that kind of devotion and gratitude. In Ajahn Chah's monasteries, or monasteries away from Thailand, quite often do an all-night meditation. And so the celebration is more contemplative rather than whoopee kind of celebration. It's not sort of Canada Day. It's Dharma Day, so it has a different tone to it. Usually lots of good food. But the tone of it is obviously contemplative. When one of the things I reflect upon often is the where I think the Buddha was coming from. And this is one must be careful, kind of conceited to think that I know where the Buddha came from, but one of the things that strikes me about his biography is that his quest or his religious search came from a very deep question, and it was a question which wasn't psychological. It wasn't like, why do I have road rage, or you know why can't I get along with my in-laws, or why am I always so worried. It wasn't that kind of a question. And contemplating the Buddha as a person rather than as a kind of a mythic hero, which is hard to touch, but just contemplating him as a person, the things that have always, some of the things that touched me about his life are his, the way he, it probably his empathy, because when I read the history of the Buddha, now it's so mixed with legend and myth and some perhaps factual things from the text, but you get a sense that like his observation of nature was one where he felt for the suffering of the worm or the sparrow being chased by the sparrow hawk or the sparrow hawk being chased by a crow. I find them fascinating. I like birding. So if I see if I see a starlings chasing a hawk of some sort, oh, isn't that neat? Right? It is neat, but if you think about the sparrowhawk or the starlings, it's not nice. It's rough. It's a rough existence. So that's one of the things that strikes me about the history of the biography of the Buddha, is that sense of empathy he had for, rather than just a kind of fascination for nature, I think he must have really felt for the suffering in nature, how beings are bound by these natural cycles. So the thing that strikes me, that the question that he asked, at least this is the way I see it, is that when he really contemplated deeply his own existence, and this is what he was doing all through his youth, he said, if I am subject to the old age, sickness and death, why would I spend this life pursuing things which are subject to old age, sickness and death? Is there a deathless element? Is there a dharma which isn't born and does not die? Wouldn't that be a worthy search? Shouldn't that be how I use my life? So that question of, if I am bound by old age, sickness and death, and that other beings are bound by that, is there something, is there an element? Is there the liberation from the cycle of old age, sickness and death? So if you think of it, that's a different kind of question than, why am I always so uptight? Why can't I just be more happy? And yet within it, those questions will be answered, certainly. So his search was for that kind of existential search. And so Buddhism's, his answer was a transcendent answer. It was a spiritual answer, a religious answer, if you will. Not in a dogmatic sense, but in a sense of liberation. So it wasn't just a psychological answer. It wasn't just an inner analysis of his neuroses. It wasn't that kind of thing. And yet, his capacity to analyze the mind and the kind of psychological teachings that come to us from 2,500 years ago are very good. They're very apt. They're appropriate. So psychology is obviously very, very important. But the deeper question was if I am subject to old age, sickness and death, is there something that, is there a dharma, an element? And in India, they've always had that. They called it the amata dhamma, the deathless. If you've heard of Amaravati, where Ajahn Sumedho lives, Amaravati is the deathless realm. So there's always been that sense in Indian philosophy and Indian spiritual search of moksha, liberation, the deathless, the end of the round of birth and death. Our culture doesn't have that so much. We come from a kind of theistic background, of religious background, but in the mystical, in the, you know, Meister Eckhart and people like that, you find those ideas are being touched upon. But it's not common coinage. You know, it's not like people talk about the deathless. You know, they talk more about the economy. Fair enough. Unemployment and productivity and a lot of talk with us about psychology, which is very, very important, healing, those kinds of things. So I think that, for me, has always been important to keep in mind in the way he first practiced. So if we look at those six or how many years he practiced, 6 or 7 years he practiced from the renunciation, it was a very, very incredibly dedicated practice to this question. If I'm subject to old age, sickness and death, is there a deathless element? So he would not settle for anything which changed. So if he had some attainments in meditation, he'd say, yeah, but it's still constructed. It began, it stayed, it was powerful, and then it ended. So it can't be that, it can't be this, it can't be that. And so because it was such a brilliant question, and because he was so devoted to that question, to that inquiry. It's like good science. If you think about good science, asks a good question. Good medical science, you have to ask a good question, and then you have to be very, very, very dedicated to that question and keep your experiment in line with that question. So one of the interesting things about his search was the many years of asceticism. You know, when we read what we think he might have done during those 6 or 7 years, there were a considerable number of years dedicated to very extreme self-mortification. Very extreme kinds of practices. And the way I reflect upon that is that our minds and our sense experience is very much preoccupied with pleasure and pain. The pleasure-pain principle is very important in just living a life biologically. But much of our attention is caught up with that, trying to avoid pain, trying to maximize pleasure. So those ascetic practices, I've thought, well, maybe there's just like, and you get this in Christian monasticism too, of this sort of austerity that I won't be moved by things which are uncomfortable. I'll just be so strong, the pleasure principle won't affect me at all. I'll just be so strong that I can take any pain, I can sit through anything, I won't even breathe. I'll hold my breath. And he tried that. Of course, he almost died. And he got so close to death that he said, "Wow, this isn't working. So there is that in I certainly noticed that in a male culture, in male monasticism, especially when I was younger, of using willpower to just, you know, just kind of willfully hold the mind in some kind of imagined position of where enlightenment might lie. So suppressing desire, getting rid of it. Because certainly I had tried the other in traveling around with longer hair before I became a monk. The hedonistic part, that experiment had been a total failure. That didn't work. So do the other one. But I don't know if that's so strong in a woman's mind, but I know in men, that kind of the willfulness of practice, especially when you're younger, just kind of doing long sittings and this is kind of really driving energy, lacks wisdom. It's not a reflective mind, it's purely willful mind. And that succeeds for a certain amount of time, but it doesn't liberate. Why? Because it's still controlled. It's still about birth and death. As long as I have to control conditions and keep them to a certain configuration, then as soon as those conditions fall away, the whole thing explodes on me. So people find that sometimes on retreat, where they use will, kind of a willful practice, and they might get the mind to some sense of stillness, but as soon as they take off that willful holding of the mind on the object of meditation, take that away, the mind just explodes back into its unfortunate habits, worry and whatever, and go off to Tim Hortons, have a donut, whatever people do after retreat. So for me, that time of the self-mortification that Gotama went through was the misuse of will. It's just kind of willfully. But the question was still there. So he attains to something, he attained to some kind of meditative experiences, that wasn't it. But all the time he was developing very good qualities. He was sharpening his capacity to investigate, to look at, to understand. He's sharpening his capacity to be patient and to watch and to endure and so on. So there's a kind of foundation being built of enlightenment. So his whatever his enlightenment was, for him it answered that question. He had realized the unconditioned, the unoriginated, the unformed Nibbana. And that's why we talk about Nibbana in Buddhism, because you know, I'm quite often facetious about that word, which is probably incorrect, but like people think Nibbana is a place, right? So you go to some kind of heavenly realm or wherever, but Nibbana was used as a word which talked about the coolness of the mind which is beyond the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion, which wasn't caught up with those things. wasn't caught up with all the energies of birth and death. So from his realization then, which set the stage for Asala Puja, or that first teaching, when he taught, the way he taught was, he taught, as most of you know, he taught the Four Noble Truths. And that's interesting because he didn't begin with you have to get this enlightenment experience, and I have. He began with what we all have, is that we all suffer, that we all have discontent, that we all yearn for some kind of more profound fulfillment than just a Dairy Queen. Or, you know, we have this kind of profound yearning in our heart. Otherwise we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't do this. We wouldn't sit quietly. And so he said, okay, if you have that yearning, right? If you have that yearning, and that yearning isn't fulfilled, then you're suffering. You have some sense of discontent. Now, that sense of discontent is a sense, if it's listened to, it is the point of awakening. Because when we have a stone in our shoe, when we finally decide to look at that stone, take our shoe off, we awaken, right? When we're sort of half walking along and that stone, I know it's there, but when we really, it's there, it's that stone, that's the problem. Now, our culture it has a very kind of strangely passive aspect to it. If you think like just driving a car, although it's an active kind of a thing, it's also physically very passive. And you you don't use your body much. Just kind of shifting things a little bit. Or television, or like vicariously watching sport, or just being in front of a television screen. It's a very kind of passive part of our lives, right? So when we suffer, like because we have so much wealth in our society, we have a lot of wealth compared to, say, the time of the Buddha, we can organize a lot of comfort. And we can have our own types of drapes. And our own type of music, and our own type of this and that. So we can create very, very beautiful environments. And so quite often, when we just have everything kind of set up the way we want, it kind of goes along real. But our minds are very, very passive, and then something comes along, some friction, some unexpected problem comes up, some conflict with the neighbor, the partner. Some aspect of sickness or whatever, and we suffer, right? and that friction and that conflict is not that one would wish it upon anyone. I wouldn't wish it upon anyone. That's when we act, don't we? We try to do something about it. I want to get out of it. So the neighbor starts playing the ghetto blaster, or I begin to develop osteoporosis in my back, or all the whole litany of stuff. And then what do we do? Well, what the Buddha's suggesting is that, well, whatever you choose, whatever way you choose to get out of that discontent, if you choose anything that is subject to change, then you'll never really totally get out of discontent. You'll be able to alter it. So you can alter your posture. Say to Yanko here is altering his posture because he's had a knee operation. Okay, he can alter that, right? And it's a kind of what we're doing. We're trying to kind of alter our posture so we get it just right. But we never get it just right. Why? Because it's always conditioned. It's always conditional related. It depends on other things. It's born and it dies. It's born and it dies. It's born and it dies. So we go back to the Buddha's question. If I am subject to old age, sickness, and death, is there an element which is not subject to old age, sickness, and death? Is there something that I'm missing? And so the Buddha's suggestion is that if, when you feel discomfort, when you feel discontent, you choose to merely distract that, that's a limited strategy. It's a useful strategy. He didn't dismiss it. So his time of asceticism pointed out that it's useful to have a good body. It's useful to have food. It's useful to have shelter. It's useful to have a situation where you can meditate. But that's not the end in itself. So is there anything in consciousness or in our experience that is not subject to old age, sickness and death? That was his question. So you get comfortable. You know, that's it. Comfort, that's it. And then, of course, you feel discomfort. And you learn this lesson in meditation. I think discomfort is such a good teacher. Again, I don't wish it upon you, and we're not going to issue cushions with nails in it next time. But you know, if you just take that little lesson of discomfort, in which we all get in meditation, take that lesson of discomfort. Now, that discomfort is born because of causes, right? Age, the limitations of the body, the hard cushion, an operation on your knee, whatever, right? And then it comes into consciousness and it stays there for a while, and then you shift your posture, right? And that's allowed. You don't have to sit there and self-mortificate. You shift your posture and you come to comfort again. So you go from comfort, a discomfort to comfort. And then after a while, you come back to discomfort again, don't you? Meditation retreats. People, you know, I used to do meditation retreats. So we sit for an hour, and then after like 40 minutes of sitting, people, oh God, when's that sitting coming? When's the walking going to come? Get up. Bell rings, comfort. Get up, find a nice walking path, pine trees, Ottawa River, right? Birds singing. Oh, it's really nice. Walking is really nice. 40 minutes, boring. Discomfort. Oh, trudge, 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 trudge. Bell rings. Ah, sitting. Tea. So the mind, comfort, discomfort, pleasure, unpleasure, right? And we're always involved in that. So if our spiritual search is simply about pleasure and comfort, then the Buddha is saying that can't be it. Not to deny, you know, the naturalness of pleasure and of comfort and discomfort. Not to say it's right or wrong, but that can't be the deathless. So if you pursue his question and you really follow that, well, if that can't be the deathless, right, then maybe I shouldn't invest so much in that. Maybe I shouldn't spend so much energy preoccupied with pleasure and displeasure. Maybe I should observe it. And again, I often try to point to this. When you're learning to meditate and you begin to be able to see discomfort as an object rather than being driven by discomfort to seek pleasure, when you see discomfort as an object and you begin to abide as a kind of witnessing peacefulness with that discomfort, you begin to understand something about consciousness. You begin to see, well, there's something deeper going on here than just pleasure and displeasure. And that's the key. That's the key. So in the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha suggests that there is suffering, or there is discontent, or there is stress, or there is an unhappiness or whatever. There is that, right? And what he suggests is that don't take it personally. Don't say, oh, my knee, or oh, my whatever. It says, no, this is life. Life has this situation of discomfort in it. Try to look at it objectively. Now that's very important, because if you don't do that, you're just caught up in self-narratives, and you never notice anything objectively, because self-narratives are endless. They just go on and on and on, on. So there's a difference between knowing knee discomfort and thinking, oh gosh, how long is this guy going to talk? My knee can't take this anymore. That's self. And there's no awareness of that. There's no awakeness in that. We want to awaken to discontent or suffering. So there is suffering rather than I am suffering. Suffering feels this way. Now that suffering has to be understood. You have to pick it up. You have to look at it. You have to understand it. Rather than try to get rid of it, judge it, or do anything in it. It has to be understood. So the second noble truth takes you to the cause. So there's a cause to this. You know, there's a beginning to this. it's causally related. And what's the cause? He says, well, it's attachment to craving. And again, if you take that example of discomfort, take the discomfort comes up, you can move, you cannot move, but what's the real problem there with the discomfort? It's the not wanting the discomfort. Now, biologically, you see, that's necessary. If we didn't move, we'd be crippled. So you say, okay, biologically, but there's deep, something deeper than that, isn't there? Because there's so much discomfort in our lives, psychologically, emotionally, with people. It's not just biological. It's something deeper. And it's our attachment to pleasure and pain. So the discomfort arises, and you say, well, it's not the discomfort. It's this resistance to this discomfort. Well, now, what is that? It's, well, I don't want this. I want something else. Well, what if I look at the wanting? And without hurting myself, without saying you should never feel, you know, you should sit through this like the Buddha for 6 years. But what if I just, for this period of time, what if I look at wanting itself? And now I get more deeply into my conscious experience. I'm no longer just reactive around the pleasure-pain principle. I'm looking more profoundly at the structure of mind. Because I'm looking at it as there is suffering and there's a cause. Not me, oh me, with my problem. There's suffering and there's a cause. And the cause is attachment to craving. Attachment, what does that mean? Well, what happens when I attach to craving? Well, if you look at discomfort, the first time it comes up, you start to feel restless. You start to think, should I move, should I not move? Is he going to ring the bell, is he not going to ring the bell? I wonder how much time's gone by. Shouldn't have come. I'm getting out of here. It depends how bad it is. The mind starts to think, and that thinking and that what we call self-narrative, that's what we mean by attachment. And that's driven by desire, driven by craving. But when we have the kind of presence of mind to just look at craving, just around like a little thing like discomfort, say, well, it's all right, I'll just be with this discomfort for a while. We begin to let go of craving. And I think we've all seen this, those who have been meditating for a while, see, the discomfort changes. It hasn't got that tension, and it becomes more of an object. We can still move if it hurts us, but the grasping of it and the struggle with it, all of a sudden, well, this is just discomfort. That's what bodies have. Bodies have discomfort. It's just the way it is. I'm not dismissing the medical system, right? Because some people take that, oh, that means you take care of the body the best you can. But you begin to see, well, even within discomfort, there's something, actually, which can know that discomfort, but is neither comfortable nor uncomfortable. And that is the doorway to the deathless. That insight, that this craving can be known, and you can let go of it, opens the mind to the deathless. Because what craving does, in the Buddhist sense of how we use tanha, craving is always the preoccupation with birth and death, with our psychology, with the things that we use, with our bodies, with our memories, with our future and our past and all of that. That's that preoccupation with the pleasure-pain principle, all the self-narratives that we have. And so as long as all our mental space is preoccupied with that, all our mental space is taken up with thought, with judgment, with self-analysis, with exciting projects or boring projects. As long as all that space is just taken up with that, then all our attention is taken up with birth and death. It's taken up with that which changes. So how can we discover the unchanging if we're just preoccupied with that which is changing all the time? But when you meditate and you begin to just notice discomfort, and no longer become preoccupied with trying to get pleasure. You just notice discomfort. Your mind begins to have spaciousness, begins to relax, and it begins to know things which are changing rather than always trying to change them. Big difference, isn't it? It's a big difference between me knowing things as they're changing and me always trying to grasp the ones I like and trying to get rid of the ones I dislike. That's why I like to start meditations with listening. You listen. Stop thinking. Listen. And your mind becomes receptive. Start judging the sound. You hear chainsaw. Ooh, I don't like that. Cardinal, I like that. The mind begins to choose and prefer. It likes the pleasant. It doesn't like. Your mind becomes preoccupied with pleasant and unpleasant. Step back and just listen. Coarse sound, refined sound, beautiful sound, ugly sound. Come and go, come and go, come and go. What doesn't come and go? The knowing. Doesn't come and go, does it? But that's very subtle. That's very, very subtle. But of course, the Buddha's insight was subtle. So there is suffering. Suffering has to be understood. Second noble truth, there is the cause. And the cause is attachment to craving. And that you have to let go. And the third noble truth is there's the realization. There's the end of suffering, Nirodha. And that has to be realized. You have to realize the mind which is not grasping. You can do that. You can do that in a meditation. You're sitting here, you start to get uncomfortable, your mind starts to get into some, wait, this is discomfort. You awaken. Just relax, you let go. This is okay. Just do it. You realize the end of suffering. Right there, just that little bit, you realize the end of craving. Oh, that's what they're talking about. Your mind starts to worry about your pension. Good thing to worry about these days. Something monks don't worry about, fortunately. So you start to worry about, now that's a very worthy thing to worry about, isn't it? And yet, at some point you realize, well, I could do the best I can, but what is this worry? Worry is the craving for security, isn't it? It's the craving to have a secure future, which you don't know, but I'll worry about it. So you decide, now, oh, what is that? Oh, this is suffering. So suffering awaken. You have to awaken to suffering. I'm going to understand this. So what's the problem? Well, I might be a bag lady. Or a bag monk. but what's the cause? What's the cause? You go back to the Four Noble Truths. You keep going back to that. What's the cause? Cause attachment to craving. Well, so what's the craving? Craving is, I want security. I want to make sure that I'm all right, which is pretty natural. Nothing wrong with that. So you do the best you can socially, but in the moment, existentially, in the moment, what's the letting go? The letting go is, well, life is this way now. And there's this tightness, there's this feeling of wanting, this feeling of fear. Feeling is, the fear is this way, it feels this way, it feels this way, it feels this way. And as you become aware of that fear, it becomes an object, just like the discomfort in your knee, just the same. But now you're the witness. You begin to just know fear is just that way, just feels that way. And you begin to see that behind the fear, there is this peacefulness. Within the fear, there's this peacefulness, which is the knowing, which is awareness. And the fear is seen as something that's changing rather than something that you are. Pick up the self narrative, ooh, you go off into thought, don't you? Analytical thinking is different than self thinking. Good, clear, analytical analysis of your stock portfolio is allowed. Neurotic thinking about what's going to happen for 10 years is also allowed, but it's probably not a good idea. But we do it, you know, we do it. So this is what attachment is. It's this preoccupation with I thought and craving and so on. So letting go is this entry into the present moment and accepting it's just this way now. Relaxing the mind, listening. And then from that spaciousness of mind, you see how this kind of grasping is going on. A sense of self is arising, past regrets, future possibilities, the mind churning on. And you keep letting go of that. You keep letting go. It's a path of letting go. So we have words like renunciation, relinquishment, letting go, abandonment. Abandonment's probably not a good word these days. It has other kind of connotations. But that's the kind of language that exists in the third noble truth, letting go. When we began this meditation, I said, get your mind to the space of non-becoming. That's a word we use. Now, non-becoming is about birth and death and me and the future. But the deathless, the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed Nibbana cannot be in the future. It has to be present, has to be imminent. It must be, by definition. It can only be. It can only be here and now and always here and now. So how do you touch that? Well, you touch that by no longer seeking anything outside the present moment. By relinquishing like the whole sense of me in the past and the future. And opening the mind to the present moment. Now this is a spiritual endeavor, this isn't a worldly endeavor. With worldly endeavors, you have to think about the past and future. Ajahn Kusala has to make sure he gets to the airport on time on the 8th so that he can get to Boston so he can teach. He doesn't just sit here on the 8th of July and think, ah, the unconditioned. And then, I'm in Boston. That's another teaching. We don't do that one. So there is conventional reality, and this is sometimes people confuse it. There's conventional truth. You know, we live by precepts. We have quite a strict structure that we live by. We have a way we relate with the laity. We have a hierarchy, and so there's all kinds of those social structures in place. So that's the worldly part, which is important. That's very, very important. So if you get the worldly part in place and you don't have to juggle with it all the time, then you can do this kind of more interesting work, the spiritual work. And the thing about it is that suffering, rather than being a hassle now, it becomes the edifier. It edifies you if you take it on board. And if you take it on board not as a personal problem, but as the seed to an existential problem, as the instigator for a deeper investigation, as the thing that awakens you, because it does, doesn't you? If you really want to be free. So I don't know what question you have in your life. When I was attempting to go to university, I went into U of T. I was a bit young, but I remember within 2 weeks of lectures, I realized this isn't it. I felt awful. I didn't know what it was, but I knew that wasn't it. And it's not that it wasn't a good course and so on, but I knew that this wasn't answering my existential question. It wasn't answering. So I got into the, okay, I'm an engineer, so what? So I have a car, so I have kids, so what? Because those are all externals. They weren't answering the inner question. And the inner question, when I came across the teaching, was, yeah, is there something that isn't just an external preoccupation? Is there something deeper than the pleasure and pain principle? And so the Buddhist, that questioning that the Buddha had has always struck me as quite relevant in my own life. Very relevant. But you can see how a good question is a form of truth, isn't it? Like, if you're not just questioning yourself in some kind of intellectual way, you know, who am I? Am I Viradhammo? No, I'm not. Yes, I am. This is just kind of silly thinking. But if you have a deep, heartfelt question, you might not know the answer, but the question will be a kind of part of your seeking of truth, won't it? All of us have some insight. All of us see the limitations of things, and we say, yeah, well, it can't be that. I've done that. It can't be there. And that kind of honesty is what kept the Buddha going. We say that in the many lifetimes that he developed the paramitas, there's one thing he could never go against, and that was truth-seeking. He can never be dishonest to his own search. And if one is honest to that kind of inner search, and one keeps attentive to that, then the truth has to reveal itself. Can't be otherwise. If the question is shallow and trivial, then just read Guinness Book of Records, right? Those are shallow questions, trivial questions. But the deeper questions: why do I suffer? Why can't I be open and compassionate to those I love? You know, why is my heart closed down? These kinds of questions. These are important questions. But the answer that the Buddha gave wasn't just psychological. Psychology Buddhist psychology is a basis for calm, is a basis for insight, but it's not an end in itself. The deeper end is a spiritual end, an insightful end of the realization of enlightenment. So on Monday, on Dharma Day, if you like, if you suffer, if during those 24 hours you suffer, see if you can bring up the Four Noble Truths. Because this is a practice. You're kind of getting uptight about something. What's the problem? Where is it? Not as a blame, but what's the craving? What do I want that I don't have? What do I have that I don't want? How does it feel? And what do I need to let go of? That's a constant training. And that's the path. That's the path that we travel. All right? I'll leave that for your reflection.
Mayam dhammavargata sadhu karam dhammasai sadhu.